3, 2. Black History Mini Docs Podcast.
Welcome to Black History Mini Docs Podcast. I'm Akeisha McCants, founder of Whole Body Literacy and Education, aka Wibble, and host of Wibble's weekly podcast, Education is Liberation. You can find us on anchor.fm/WHBLE or wherever you get your podcasts. Wibble is an educational consultancy company. We make art, we make change, we activate and inspire community connection, encouraging individual and collective literacies, and nurturing brave spaces using media and the arts. I'm excited to have with us for this episode, Spirit Tawfiq. Spirit Tawfiq is founder of Roots of the Spirit, a business created to uproot racism through storytelling, education, and the arts. Spirit is the creator and host of Roots of the Spirit's podcast, a space to galvanize change through honest conversations about identity, race, racism, and intersectional social justice issues. Welcome, Spirit.
Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. It's such an honor and pleasure. I'm so excited to have our conversation.
Tell us about yourself and your work.
Sure. So I think that the work that I do now has been formed and shaped and molded by my life experience. And so I could give you a broad overview because it kind of goes back to my early childhood. I was born and raised in Northern Ontario, Canada, and I'm like one of six kids. We lived on a farm. Wilderness was our playground. That was just our regular life. And so I never looked at myself and thought, oh, something's strange, something's different, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. It was once I went to school, children began to bully myself and my siblings, call us derogatory names, the N-word. Mm. And that was the first time that something was brought to my awareness about racial identity. I never looked at my mother, who is Black, and looked at my father, who is white, and thought, oh, this is strange. None of that. Mm. And so my identity was brought to my attention in a negative way from the outside. Mm. And so the irony and why I start there is because as a young person, I didn't know how to navigate that. And so from a very early age, like first and second grade, I have very keen, vivid memories of being isolated, ostracized, and feeling like I didn't belong all the way up until the seventh grade. And then it's almost like I had an awakening because I found out that my mother was one of the Little Rock Nine. So wow. Here I was experiencing bullying. I felt really ashamed by my experience. I never came home and told my mother, this is what's happening. And I think that's a common experience. We don't necessarily tell our parents. Mm-hmm. And then when I found out about my mother's experience, I was like, whoa, you mean to tell me my mother had to have a soldier take her to school? Wow. And so from that point forward, from the moment that I found out about my mother, I fell in love with that story. And then fast forward over 25 years, I've still been continuing to dive into that story, wanting to pass on that legacy, keep the story alive, and empower young people with the richness of that story and other stories that are connected to our history.
Wow. I mean, first of all, that's incredible. I mean, you speak to the true experience of Black children, even in Canada, right?
I think the lid got blown off of the fact that Canada doesn't have racism. Like in this moment, it's you know, the curtain is open. Mm. And I think that it really made myself and my siblings and many of my fellow Black Canadians feel like, okay, there's like validated an experience. You know, we knew, but it was kind of a collective, Canada's different. And I think that we came to a reckoning that not so much.
Wow, and maybe even your mom felt that maybe leaving the US, given her experiences, that might be better, huh?
Yeah, it's so interesting because it's a really interesting dynamic because in some ways there are elements of Canada that are different. However, and especially during that time, like my mother and father left the United States during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. So they literally left because they didn't believe in fighting in a war. They didn't believe it. So they left. So in other words, Canada at that time was an oasis. They were embraced, like the draft dodger community was embraced, and they were able to set up their family home and You know, and I think that in conversations later in life, I've asked my mother about her awareness of the racism that we experienced. And because we didn't talk about it, she wasn't really aware of it.
Yeah, you bring up a really important conversation, because I think at a certain point, given the heightened conversations around racism at the time, I mean, this was 1957 when your mom was about to desegregate a school. And so these conversations since the passing of Brown versus the Board of Education felt like, well, with the desegregation, the conversation maybe is not as pertinent now because we've worked through some things. Mm-hmm. You know, I would actually love to share a mini doc right now that we have on the Little Rock Nine, and your mom included, of course. Let's cut to that real quick. Black History Mini Doc.
Been here before. Somewhere in time, I remember wondering why so much hate. It was a long time ago. A feeling of despair, helplessness. No matter how loud I cried out, no one wanted to hear my voice. No matter how much pain I suffered, no one wanted to feel my pain. I've been here before. A sense of loneliness. A sense of no hope. I've been here before. Except now, I'm here. And now is then. I've been here before. I've had them kick me and beat me. Maybe perhaps I could make them see somehow how wrong they are. I thought perhaps maybe times have changed. Things have moved on. But the only thing that really changed was time.
So, as a professional speaker and playwright, you go around the world talking about your mother's legacy. And do you often bring in your story as a part of that conversation?
Absolutely. I bring in how I learned the story because I think it's interesting. It's telling. The fact that my mother didn't sit her children down and tell us about her experience as one of the Little Rock Nine, come to find out, I share that experience with other children of the Nine, as we kind of call ourselves. And a twist of fate landed me in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I ended up working at the Little Rock Central High National Historic Site, where she desegregated the school for 10 years. So I had the opportunity to meet people from around the world and kind of give their insight into what that event meant to them, the significance, the magnitude. And I share that because along that journey, I met veterans of wars who shared a kinship in not telling their children about the trauma that they experienced. And so I think it's interesting looking at it like that, because it was and is such deeply embedded trauma that was and is inflicted. I think that's an important part of the conversation, that I use my story and the trajectory of how I learned my mother's story to bring up mental health impact of racism. And then also, just being somebody who is Black and white, and that experience and vantage point, and experiencing racism in that realm, so to speak. So I feel like I infuse my journey because I really want to help young people understand that it's not about them. It's about the sickness of racism in this country and worldwide. And that once we know that and we understand how it moves and maneuvers and lives in our minds, bodies, souls, and psyches, then I feel like we're better equipped to resist it and to go on with our lives and fulfill our dreams. And you know what I mean? Of course, racism is still very real. But once you kind of know how it works, I think that it's empowering.
I agree. You know, oftentimes these are the taboo conversations. How do we, you know, and these conversations need to happen still to this day, as we're seeing with COVID-19, with the school situation. Young Black children are experiencing trauma on a daily basis. And I want to like reframe it to this monumental time with your mom. I mean, before, you know, when Brown versus the Board of Education was passed and they said that they could desegregate the school in Arkansas, the National Guard was called to, quote, preserve the peace, which meant keeping your mom and her peers from entering the school building. And so it wasn't like, and that was on, what was it, September 4th of 1957. It wasn't until September 25th of 1957 when she finally got to walk through that school door. Surrounded by the National Guard and angry, violent, vile people cussing at her. I read about one of her peers, someone spat on them. When you finally had this conversation with your mom, you know, what was that like?
So I learned about it around the seventh grade, and I had little hints along the way, and there's kind of a interesting story that goes along with it. So all this time I'm living in Canada, and it's just not a part of my awareness. And so in 1987, my mother took my little sister Layla and I on a trip to Little Rock, Arkansas. So we were excited because we were going to see our family, and we just, like, you know, my granny, my aunts, my cousins, etc. So it was 87. I was 7 years old, knew nothing about my mother's story. And so I do keenly remember on one occasion being at a very elegant dinner and being proud of my, how, like, I was so using my utensils. I mean, I just remember it. And I had no idea what the event was, but it turns out that it was 1987. Bill Clinton, as governor, had invited the Little Rock Nine to the governor's mansion. Mm-hmm. The twist of irony is that 30 years prior, the governor was there to keep the Little Rock Nine out. Now the sitting governor was inviting the Nine to come and welcome them into this home. Mm. So the interesting element is that Chelsea Clinton is one of the very first people who articulated why we were there and what we were doing, what the significance was. We were kids. We were like hanging out with her in her basement and her playground. So that kind of just sat dormant. I didn't have any context around it. Went back to Canada, lived life. And then when Bill Clinton was elected president, I remember my mother telling me about the Arkansas governor that we had visited. So it was starting to make sense. Still, I was young in Canada, not really interested in American politics. But what ended up happening is my mother showed an Eyes on the Prize video at an event.
And I remember the Eyes on the Prize. I feel like every Black child who was up in a certain era, that was what we had to watch.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. However, Eyes on the Prize is amazing. It's like incredibly rich history, etc. But for a child, it didn't really penetrate. Things were starting to click. We had Chelsea, we have this Eyes on the Prize, but what really kind of brought it to life was the fact that the Ernest Green story came out. It was a Disney movie. This was literally like the year after Boys in the Hood came out, and Morris Chestnut was the lead in the Ernest Green story. So here there was a Disney movie about my mother's life experience, and I was like, Mom, you act like this is no big deal. And then there was a Scholastic book released by one of the Little Rock Nine called Warriors Don't Cry. And then when I was 16, my mother was invited to be on the Oprah show. And that's when Oprah was like, she's still the queen, but I'm saying she had her show. It was just colossal. So I think that, and then also President Clinton invited the Little Rock Nine as president to welcome the Nine back. So we got to go back to Little Rock and experience this, like, the magnitude of what this meant. So I say all that to say that it was an evolution of understanding. It's not something that I learned about overnight. And I feel like once I fell in love with the story, I started asking questions. And the answer that I got out of giving you that entire background is that my mother said, when I asked her, she said she didn't have the context to place it in. And I was like, But then she kind of further explained that the country had not acknowledged that the Central High crisis happened. And that's something that my understanding, really a light bulb went off this year. Like how deep that is, that the country really hadn't acknowledged it. Like on a national level. But really at the end of the day, it's because it was so painful. And there was so much trauma associated with entering the school to begin with, but then also what happened inside the school. And then the fact that they didn't have soldiers at their houses. So a lot of the abuse and terrorism happened outside of the school.
Wow. I mean, that's leaving me wordless. Like, you know, to think about all that she went through, and there was still this feeling that maybe it wasn't important, maybe, to speak about it, because on a certain level, it's like, it's your experience, and maybe it feels singular, and it doesn't feel as a part of the fabric of a larger story, a larger continuum, even for her. And how old was she at the time?
You mean in terms of when she told us?
Oh, when she experienced that trauma as a student. How old was she?
When she signed up to go to Central, she was 15, and then she turned 16 during the year. And I think what's interesting about her experience and many the other members of the Nine and everyone during that era is she was the same exact age as Emmett Till. And so she grew up as a young Black girl in segregation. As she describes it, she said, it's like clutching a chain linked fence, looking at a world I was not allowed to participate in. You know, she experienced and lived Jim Crow. So, but there were some things that happened that, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, and then some desegregation in other area schools. And they didn't have this, the magnitude of the crisis, how it erupted so violently. And so she had this knowing, but nobody knew, had a clue what was about to happen.
And then I read somewhere that she didn't actually, she wasn't able to complete her studies at Central. What happened there?
So to paint a picture, I really like the way you framed it in terms of like they tried to get in on the first day, the governor blocked them, then they left, they were out of school for a few weeks, and then finally what happened is Eisenhower called in over 1,200 soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division, Elite Army Division. He federalized the Arkansas National Guard, so the school literally looked like a war zone. Soldiers came in jeeps and helicopters and set up camp. And then on September 25th, they made it inside the school for the very first day of classes. So the mob remained outside, screaming, jeering, taunting. They beat up some Black reporters. There's a very famous video of Alex Wilson being hit in the head with a brick. So they made it inside the school, and they each had their own soldier to walk them to and from class. They couldn't go in the change rooms, bathrooms, gym class. And so that's where the harassment took place. So on a regular basis, of course, they were called the N-word. The students stepped on the back of their heels until they bled. They threw soup on their clothes. Hot soup was thrown in their face, on their clothes, acid, all kinds of different ways of continuing to assault them every single day. So their strategy was nonviolence. They had to maintain that. So when something happened, they had to adapt and be nonviolent and ignore it and keep moving. I mean, the principal even said at a certain point, you can leave a change of clothes in the office because it was inevitable that something would be on it by the end of the day. So my mother was like a super vivacious, cheerful young teenager. And come to find out years later, a psychologist wrote a book about it. And the students said they hated her so much because she acted like she belonged there. Wow. And so that air of confidence and that resistance literally drove them insane. And so she, like, there was like a really serious campaign to break her down. And so in December, which is like September, October, November, a few months into the school year, she was in the cafeteria trying to get to her seat. Some boys blocked her, wouldn't let her pass, and she was just tired of it. And so when she tried to be nonviolent and tried to just, you know, they just continued with the harassment and she was just done. So she picked up her tray and it had chili on it and she accidentally on purpose dropped it. And chili splattered on the boys. And by today's standards, doesn't sound like much of a big deal. But back then, to defy the bully was like extreme.
So to defy the white bully.
Exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. They were livid. So mm-hmm. What happened is she was suspended. She got to come back to school. And an element that's not really a part of the narrative is she did two things during that school year, which I think kind of, in addition to her confidence and her spirit, she questioned her teacher about why there was like this small of a paragraph on slavery in their textbook. And she also asked to sing in the Christmas concert. So she was in the Glee Club, and that was like the end goal of being in the Glee Club is that the class is going to sing in the Christmas concert. But the teacher told her, you can't. You, only you can't. So she questioned that. So when she was suspended, got to come back. She was walking down the hall. Some girls were harassing her, calling her names. Nothing out of the ordinary. She ignored it. They were following her up a couple flights of stairs. She ignored it. But one of them picked up or had her purse and it had combination locks in it. And she swung it and hit her in the side of the head. So when it hit her, she was in shock, enraged, hurt. And she said, leave me alone, white trash. So those words were overheard by one of the authorities at the school. And she was told she was suspended, but ultimately they expelled her.
Wow. Leave me alone, white trash. A person hits someone with a bag full of combination locks. And everything that you're saying, which speaks to like even now, this fight for Black lives, right? And the audacity for Black folks to be expecting rights here in this country that we built after all this time of denial of our human rights, our basic human rights. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes too, when the retelling of these stories erases these important moments of resistance that, you know, are almost like, because why, you know, if a Black person is speaking up for themselves and, you know, drops the chili, you know, it was an accident, because why would they feel fed up by this kind of abuse? And why would it be okay for them to stand up for themselves? And, you know, when you think about your work now and your name too, like, you know, how do you feel called?
I mean, as you're speaking, I feel like I'm swelling up with emotion because I just feel very strongly about everything you said in terms of the denial and from whom we come from and the strength and resilience and the resistance. That is not the narrative. And I do everything that I can to try to bring the truth about the narrative. Mm-hmm. Even my grandmother, Imogene Brooks Brown, she was born in 1916. And during, you know, those years, you would have milk delivered to your house. That was just a thing. And she would tell the milkman, she said, you will not call me Imogene. You will call me Mrs. Brown. And that was like unheard of for a Black woman to stand her ground in that way. And I just feel so privileged to have discovered my mother's legacy, and then that kind of like opening up an entire universe of stories, like
and the power and beauty of having that moment where she could finally speak her story to you had to be one of the most powerful moments for her as a mother. And you know raising kids, you know, you get into the you know, you get into the swing of things and you forget all of your journey and how important that the, you know, the textual lineage, as Dr. Alfred Tatum would talk about, when it comes to like learning about ourselves as Black people, we often just get the story they want us to know, or the story that leaves us wanting, am I not more than just an enslaved descendant? Am I not more than just a person who was, you know, whose family was denied entry, you know? And in those stories, when we hear that our ancestors were, and our people who are still living were like actively fighting despite being spat upon, you know, being violently treated as a young person. Like, and I just, you know, can you talk to us about your work? You know, and I also, I really am curious about your name and like how your mom came to name you Spirit.
Wow, I just love, this is such a wonderful conversation, and I just have to say thank you, because it helps me reflect as well. And just in terms of my name, I believe I was named by my father. And initially my name was Mariah. I think that my mother gave me that name because that was my great, great, great grandmother who was enslaved name. And then somehow it changed to Esprit and then Spirit. And growing up, being the only child of color, and then my name being Spirit, and kids thought I was Native American, and it was like, there was so much stuff thrown at me, like identity, harassment, and abuse because of these different elements. But I've definitely come to appreciate my name and also understand the significance of names. And so I honor it, and I'm thankful for it, but it wasn't something that was always easy. Mm-hmm. One thing that's something you mentioned made me think of is that, in a way, leading into the work that I do. So long story short, born and raised in Canada, my mother got a job in the U.S. when I was 19. So I had started university in Canada, but we were excited about moving to the States. That's where my family, a lot of my extended family was. We came to the States, we lived in Maryland for a while, and then we moved to Little Rock, Arkansas. And that was a complete twist of fate. My little sister and I were like, we're going to LA and we're going to go into acting. That didn't work out. So I ended up staying in Little Rock, and I ended up working at the historic site that I mentioned. And I mentioned that because it shaped me in so many different ways. I literally was the catalyst for bringing my mother's deep wounds, deep sadness and sorrow to the forefront, not just for her, but for her mother, my grandmother, for my Aunt Phyllis, for my family. It was literally like my working at the historic site and bringing home these stories and keeping this story just ever present and being in the town where it happened, and the town, literally the city, coming to their own reckoning and not reconciliation, but the conversations around that. It played a huge role. And I just, once I found out the depths of this story, I couldn't walk away. I actually tried. I left Little Rock, and I left and went and took a promotion in Seattle for 2 years. And I felt like my world was like crumbling, because it's part of my calling to keep this story alive. So what happened is I ended up figuring out, that was necessary to leave it, walk away, because I had to figure out my identity in it. And like, how does this, I can still be my own person and carry that legacy and honor my own experience and carry the torch or the baton. And so I had to figure that all out. So then I moved to New York, and I ended up working for the Smithsonian, which is like the cousin agency of the National Park Service, which is where I worked for 12 years. And although I absolutely loved what I was doing, I literally had to take a leap of, I don't call it faith, but maybe intuition, that I knew that my calling was so great. It's like I could just feel it pulling me. And I left my federal job, as people are like, you're crazy. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I have a calling. So I left it all and I founded Roots of the Spirit.
That's beautiful. And you know, what you speak to, a number of things come up for me. One, walking in the footsteps of the people we love. I feel the same way about my parents. You know, my mom's a trailblazer, the first Black woman to direct a sitcom in the history of television. And for many years, I was like, who am I in this continuum? I really wanted to know that I had my own place. And sometimes I think, you know, just growing up, you feel like I have to make a name for myself that is my own. And it's just true. And it's important. But there's also great value for Black folks that we have to remember these footsteps we walk in, because so many people want to deny those footsteps even exist. And in, I think about, you know, the Little Rock Nine as the name, but these people had names. Your mom, Minnie Jean, you know, and I think about Say Her Name and how important it is that you, you know, bringing your mother's name to the foreground and saying, this is her name. She has a name. She isn't just a part of this group or collection of people. She has a name. She has a story. It's beautiful. And what are the names of the others who were a part of the Little Rock Nine? Do you know their names?
Absolutely. So Terrence, I have two paintings. So Carlotta Walls Lanier, Dr. Terrence Roberts, Thelma Mothershed Ware, Elizabeth Eckford, Gloria Ray Karlmark, Ernest Green, Thomas Jefferson, Minnie Jean Brown Tricky, and Elizabeth Eckford. Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, my mother is my mother. So even though I'm like really into her story and I do what I do in terms of carrying that legacy forward in the story, it really kind of hits me how another part of me views my mother's legacy when I'm around the other members of the Nine. I'm like, oh my God, this Dr. Terrence Roberts. He's such a genius. And so it gives me an understanding of like the compartmentalization of my legacy.
And you have a legacy that you've created for yourself, Roots of the Spirit. And you have a podcast too, and you have had some really big names on your podcast. Tell us about your podcast and, you know, and where we can catch it and listen to it.
Awesome. Thank you. So Roots of the Spirit is my platform to galvanize change through honest conversations about race, racism, and social justice. I put it in quotes because it's a myth. We have mythology and ideology around it, and it has very real life consequences. As you like, I know that I'm just articulating why I must put the quotes up. So I went to school for journalism. I have just like this deep desire to bring stories forth through different channels of media, whether it's film, storytelling, the arts, and podcasts. So what happened is I created Roots of the Spirit, and it was actually a video series just interviewing amazing people who are stepping into their calling. And of course, with like a social justice angle. But what happened is it just was very difficult to maintain with having a video crew and editing. It was just like, there was a lot that went into it. So I decided, I was like, wow, okay. So I have experience in radio production. I can do this. So I kind of transformed it into a podcast. And so I guess you can say a snapshot of some of my guests are my mother, of course. I call her a core roots respondent, just a scholar and her incredible wisdom.
Say that one more time.
A core roots respondent.
Love that.
Kind of an inside thing that I say, mother, you're a core roots respondent. I need you. Mm. So, of course, she's on the podcast. I've also interviewed Dr. Todd Allen, who's a professor at Messiah College. He really helped me understand and solidify one of the values of the podcast, which is to help build an informed historical perspective, which comes from Dr. Terrence Roberts, one of the Little Rock Nine. But it really helped ground me in the purpose of the interviews that I do and the conversations. I also have Jason Ward, who is a birder who happens to be Black, who is just enthralled, fascinated, and loves birds and has been birding for quite some time from the Bronx. He has his own show, and it's just a very interesting journey. And unfortunately, a part of his experience and journey is racism.
Yeah.
I also have one of my most popular podcasts is Jane Elliott, who is a famous third grade teacher, white teacher, who taught her students the brown eyes, blue eyes exercise. She said, not to be confused with the experiment, and just how that came about and how that exercise has manifested and grown and has really brought to light the ills of racism in our society. And many other amazing guests, but those are a couple that kind of stand out to me.
I mean, that sounds like an incredible lineup. And it's a very important conversation to have. You know, we can't shy away from this conversation around racism.
For sure. And I think, like, just thinking about Jason Ward and just the incident with the Central Park situation that took place, like, these just pointing out those three guests, it's kind of indicative of how racism permeates every aspect of our society. And, you know, for some, this is a brand new enlightenment, but for people who have lived it, we've been saying this for years.
Yeah. We've been saying this for years. We've had our own experiences. We've had experiences that we've, like, put, I mean, I know for myself, I didn't realize how much I experienced in racial stress that I experienced as a young person. And even as a mother, having those conversations with my kids and wanting to be forthcoming about those things, sometimes they don't want to talk about it or don't know how to process what has happened to them and microaggressions that are really, like, damaging, that seep into your subconscious, that make you feel like, you know, less than, or to question your belonging. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think back to your childhood and your mother's journey and your ancestor, you know, your ancestor's journey, thinking about the next generation, folks right now during this time, what advice would you give folks when thinking about reclaiming their lineage and also their own personal experiences? What advice would you give them?
Such a beautiful question. I'm all about the truth. And most recently, I've fallen so in love with Ida B. Wells in relation to a project that I've been working on. And she has this quote that in order to correct wrongs, we need to shine the light of truth upon them. I'm paraphrasing, but something to that effect. And I think that telling the truth, the unvarnished truth about the history of this country, is so necessary in order for us to understand this moment right now. It literally is a roadmap and a blueprint, and we should not be surprised that we're in the situation that we're in, because we deliberately entrenched ourselves in racism, racist policies, practices to get us to this moment. So, and I also, to your comment about, like, your children, I try my best. Like, I think that I'm trying really hard to create a balance also of presenting the resistance, the strength, and the legacy of that, along with the truth that's very traumatizing, so that there's something extremely positive to connect to. I know, like, young people, you know, because the floodgates open with us being able to contribute to the narrative, there's so many stories that have been buried that is coming out all at once. And some young people have expressed exhaustion, fatigue, and it's just a lot. And so, yeah, I completely understand that, because there's a balance of I want young people to feel free and not to have this fear, but you also need to know the dangers that exist. And I'm just really trying to, I have a workshop that I call Uprooting Racism One Story at a Time. And it's about telling our stories. So my mother experienced something, and she happened to be in a place and a time, and the media was present. They documented it for the world to see. So for every moment in our history, for every one of my mothers or the Little Rock Nine, there are thousands of people who went through the same exact experience. We just don't know their story. And I use my journey to understanding my mother's story and role in that legacy to encourage young people, adults alike, to learn your story. From who do you come from, like, from a familial, but also collectively, just kind of playing on roots of the spirit. We have to look back in order to come forward in the spirit of Sankofa, and also looking at the truth.
I mean, that's beautiful. And it makes me think again about your mother. feeling the need to find context in her story. And there's always context. Mm-hmm. You know, give yourself permission to tell your story. There's always someone who can benefit from knowing your story and grow from knowing your story, as I have grown from hearing yours. Thank you so much, Spirit, for your wonderful time and your story. And also, how can people reach you?
Thank you so very much. Again, such a pleasure and honor. So my Roots of the Spirit podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher. It's also on my website, rootsofthespirit.com. And then I'm on Instagram and Facebook. I also have a Roots of the Spirit Facebook community. So anything and everything related to racial injustice, justice, you can join our community, and we'd love to have you to help push the needle forward and become a more just society. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And this has been Black History Mini Docs podcast. We've been here with Spirit Taufik.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you and learning more about your mother's tremendous legacy and the work that you've done to bring light to her story. We appreciate you. And definitely be sure to check out Spirit's podcast and leave us your comments. Leave us your comments, share, subscribe. Keep supporting Black podcasts and Black businesses. This has been Black History Mini Docs podcast.
5, 4, 3, 2, Black History Mini Docs podcast. Black History Mini Docs.